First Samuel chapter 22. First Samuel 22. David, our good King David, having not king yet, but king elect, survived his experience as a slob in front of Achish, the king of Gath, next finds his slobby self in a cave. Just keeps getting better, doesn't it? You have to wonder how far down a person will go before he gets his thinking corrected. And this is David we're talking about, not Saul. This is David. The narrative part of this is all Old Testament narrative. There's no poetry here. But the narrative part here in 1 Samuel, this particular part, uses a literary technique where it simply goes back and forth and back and forth. You'll see a few verses about David, then a few verses about Saul, then a few verses about David, and then a few verses about Saul. You won't actually see, it will continue that, let me put it that way, until I think it's chapter 24 where David and Saul actually come within the same proximity. Even though Saul's kind of knocked out sleeping and David's not. It's just, there's just this back and forth, this literary divide which goes on. Just want to mention that. Okay, verse 1 and verse 2. David therefore departed thence, got out of Nob, away from Gath, and escaped to the cave Adullam. It should be the cave of Adullam, or a cave of Adullam. And when his brethren and all his father's house heard it, they went down thither to him. The area around Adullam is known even today still for the many limestone caves that are there. Limestone is a soft stone, and it easily washes out or easily gets chopped out or carved out. And there are just a lot of naturally occurring and some man-formed caves in that particular area. Significant numbers of people could be hidden in those caves. Adullam, the name, the word, means refuge. So David goes and seeks refuge in a cave of Adullam. And what we have here is pretty much just basic everyday common sense, which isn't so common anymore, of course, but they still had it back then. David is Saul's enemy, and if Saul would attack his own family, what might he do to David's family? Y'all are looking at me like you forgot that David attacked his own family. Do you not remember David attacked his own family? Saul? Turn to chapter 20. 1 Samuel chapter 20. Back a few pages. You remember this? Verse 32. Jonathan answered Saul, his father, and said to him, "Wherefore shall he be slain?" Why do you want to kill David? What has he done? Look at this. Saul cast a javelin at him to kill him. Saul threw a javelin at his own son, Jonathan, whereby Jonathan knew it was determined of his father to kill David. You know, we remember so easily Saul throwing a javelin at David that we tend to forget he also threw one at his own kid. I mean, Saul's losing it. So David's family comes to David at Adullam for protection. And remember, they are witnesses to Samuel's anointing of David. And the fact that David is going to replace Saul as king someday is by this time what we might now call an open secret. It hasn't been revealed via, you know, the New York Times or the Jerusalem Times or the Bethlehem Herald, but it, that worked pretty good, the Bethlehem Herald. But It's an open secret. People now know. Verse 2. And everyone that was in distress, David's attracting others. And everyone that was in debt, and everyone that was discontented with who? Well, with Saul, gathered themselves unto David, and he became a captain over them. And there were with him about 400 men. Now, when the Bible does that, when the Bible distinguishes the number of men and doesn't say anything about women and children, you are to assume there are women and children there unless they're specifically excluded. It's just the old Hebrews way of shorthand. If there were 400 men, there were 350, 400 wives, and how many kids? So this is a good-sized troop of people. Remember that word troop, it'll come up. And this, by the way, is the first time we're told that David has these 400 men alongside him. I doubt they all arrived in mass, but that really doesn't matter. Look at verse 3. David went thence to Mizpah of Moab, and he came unto the king of Moab, and he says, "Let my father and my mother, I pray thee, come forth and be with you, till I know what God will do for me." Now, Mizpah means watchtower. So he goes from a place of refuge to a place where he can watch, or where someone else can watch his family. And once again, we really don't know where this is in Moab. Archaeologists and scholars just don't know. Why Moab? Anybody want to hazard a guess? Has something to do with his family. He's taken his family back to Moab. Do you remember who David's great-grandmother is? That dear, sweet lady named Ruth. Ruth, the Moabitess. Now you know why, in the book of Ruth, almost every time she is mentioned or named, she is called Ruth the Moabitess. Why? Now you know why. So that we would remember when we get to a place like this, and then we would realize, oh, that's why David went to Moab. He's got family there. Great-great-grandmother. Bible doesn't put any single words in there by mistake or without purpose. We're supposed to go. That's a trigger. That's a thing that reminds you of something. So we'd remember when we get here. It's the same thing that happens in the Joseph account. You're in the middle of the Joseph account, and all of a sudden you hear about which son was it, Matt? Help me out. The oldest, not Judah, was it Judah? Went down and consorted with the harlot in chapter 38. Right? It gets ugly in chapter 3. Well, why? Reuben, thank you. Because later we would get this question and go, why did this, it's in Ruth, why does the genealogy start here? Because it's to remind you to go back there to Genesis 38 and read that chapter, and you'll get your answers. Well, apparently, the king of Moab says to David, okay, well, your ragtag collection can camp out here. That's okay. We'll watchtower over them. Look at verse 4. He brought them before the king of Moab, and they dwelt with him all the while David was in the hold. But as always happens, God has a better plan. Throughout the Old Testament, you will always see God preferring his people to be in the promised land, not Egypt, not Moab, not in Edom. So verse 5, the prophet Gad said unto David, abide not in the hold, depart, get thee into the land of Judah. Then David departed and came into the forest of Hareth. It's the first mention of the prophet Gad. Now, his name ought to be familiar because one of the 12 sons of Jacob was named Gad. That's one of the tribes. and I don't know if there's any connection or anything. I don't know that. He is a prophet, and apparently after Samuel had died, and now in a time of great need for David, the Lord provides a replacement for Samuel in this prophet named Gad. Have you lived that truth in your own life yet?
Just in your time of great need, the Lord sends someone to encourage you. Someone comes alongside to help you. Someone who sits with you and talks with you and maybe shows you scripture and helps you understand things that you might not realize. Or how about simply to remind you of a truth or two that you actually know, but in the current state of distress, you don't remember them. They don't come to your mind. Have you lived that experience in your life yet? The Lord knows our needs long before we even know there is a need. Trust Him. Gad's name means troop, as in a number of people, as in a troop of soldiers. And Gad will remain with David for many years. You don't have to turn, but if you went all the way to 2 Samuel chapter 24, when David was up in the morning, the word of the Lord came unto the prophet Gad, David's seer, saying, and then he had a message for David from the Lord. Again, we do not know today where the forest of Hereth is. No sense in having a map tonight. The king-elect is going to need a word from the Lord. And in that time, the prophets of God supplied exactly that, words from the Lord. So David is supplied by the Lord with Gad. Now that's it for the section of David. Now a few words from our sponsor. How about a few words about Saul? See, I'd really rather listen to our sponsor than Saul. I don't want to spend a lot of capital on Saul or on Saul's words or Saul's actions. We're wanting to see the development of a character in this short study, which I don't know how long it will last. And we want to see that development of that character, David. But it occurs to me, none of our characters develop in a vacuum, in isolation. None of us develop our character all by ourselves. And if you've ever met someone who thinks they've done that, they're a pretty nasty person. We all develop our character, what does the Bible say? Iron sharpens iron. We develop our character by rubbing with other Christians, by working with them or without them, or working through something with them together. So, I say all that to say we have to read about Sorry Saul. Verse 6. When Saul heard that David was discovered and the men that were with him, now Saul abode in Gibeah under a tree in Ramah, having a spear in his hand, and all his servants were standing about him. Does that sound familiar? Do you remember back when David showed up and inquired, why are y'all standing here listening to this heathen out here in the field besmirch the character of the God of Israel? What was Saul doing with his men? They were sitting there doing nothing. And that's what Saul's doing here. Saul said to his servants that stood about him, hear now, you Benjamites, and I remember that, because in a number of weeks from now, maybe months, this business of Saul being of the tribe of Benjamin is going to come back. It's one of these markers that's thrown along the way. Will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards and make you all captains of thousands and captains of hundreds? That all of you have conspired against me, there is none that showeth me that my son had made a league with the son of Jesse, and there's none of you that is sorry for me, or showeth unto me that my son hath stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait as at this day. Oh my goodness, you big baby. Has anyone been counting the number of times that we've been studying the text that the text tells us that Saul had a spear in his hand? Anybody made a count? You wouldn't thought to do that, would you? I didn't either. Well, actually, I did. It would be interesting to know, to note, that in 1 Samuel 18, 10 and 11, Saul is described as having a spear in his hand. In 1 Samuel 19, 9 and 10, he is sitting again with a spear in his hand. In 1 Samuel 20, verse 33, he is described as having a spear in his hand. In 1 Samuel 22, 6, he is described as having a sword in his hand. In 1 Samuel 26, 7, he is sleeping with a sword right beside him. I kind of think that old Saul has developed a streak for violence. You think? Or maybe something else. Maybe paranoia? He surely has become a man prone to violence, though. Now, with reference to Saul's little speech here, I'd like to make fun of it. Does not Saul sound like a modern-day politician? This is a pity party to beat all pity parties. No one likes me. Everyone hates me. I think I'll go eat worms. No one told me that David and my own son were partners against me. None of you all told me, and he's addressing them directly. No one is even sorry for me. Oh, woe is me. Whine, whine, whine. This guy's the king. Will David give each one of you a chicken in every pot? I will. I'll take care of you. Will David take care of you? You treacherous traitors, you have all conspired, his word, against me. You think there's some paranoia there? Because no one had conspired against Saul. No one. I say Saul is overstating things a little bit. Well, one of them in that audience says, "Oh, yeah. Now I remember. I saw David." Well, why didn't he speak up sooner? Was he, kind of like scared or ashamed? I'm going to give Doeg the benefit of the doubt here, because in the end, we will find that Doeg the Edomite is a treacherous, conniving murderer. He was not shamed into revealing where David was. Verse 9. Then answered Doeg the Edomite, who was set over the servants of Saul, and said, "I saw the son of Jesse coming to Nob, to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitov." Remember, the B's are V. Ahitov. Get it right. "And he," this is Ahimelech, "inquired of the Lord for him, David, and gave him food, and gave him the sword of Goliath the Philistine." David is betrayed by Doeg the Edomite. He is not even an Israeli. So armed with the new intelligence, Saul sends for the priest, Ahimelech. In fact, he calls all the priests that were at Nob. Look at verse 11. "Then the king sent to call Ahimelech the priest, the son of Ahitub, and all his father's house, the priests that were in Nob, and they came, all of them, to the king. And Saul said, 'Hear now, thou son of Ahitub.' And he answered, 'Here am I, my lord.'" Now pay attention, because every word here is important. "And Saul said unto him, 'Why have you conspired against me, thou and the son of Jesse, in that thou hast given him bread and a sword, and hast inquired of God for him, that he should rise against me to lie in wait as at this day?'" Now, why does someone lie in wait for someone else? To kill them, right? I mean, that's what we're talking about here. First thing you need to notice, the disrespectful way of addressing Ahimelech and David. He references them by their father's name, not by their own names. Ahimelech did not address Saul like that. He answered, "Here I am, my lord." That would be the proper address back to a king. But Saul does not show a priest of Israel hence not the priest God, the same kind of respect to use his name. Secondly, what was that interaction between David and Ahimelech? Was it a conspiracy? Not hardly. A dictionary definition of conspiracy goes like this: an agreement between two or more persons to commit a crime or accomplish a legal purpose through illegal action. We are currently living through an event, and the results of that event in our land today that have been improperly labeled a conspiracy. And the other word being thrown around quite liberally is insurrection. Insurrection, as defined by the dictionary, is the act or an instance of open revolt against civil authority or a constituted government. Now let's put this together. A former president is accused of conspiring to create an insurrection against our elected government. Ahimelech and David are being accused of a conspiracy to overthrow Saul. But just saying it or calling it such does not make it so. King Saul, calling the exchange between David and Ahimelech a conspiracy to create an insurrection against Saul, does not make it one. The truth is that David went to Ahimelech and asked for food and a weapon for self-defense. Why? Because he was fleeing from Saul, who had twice tried to kill him. He was not planning to engage Saul. What happens next is just plain sad and so avoidable, except for Saul's vindictive, unrighteous judgment. Ahimelech may have avoided what Saul is about to do, which is killing, if he'd have just answered in the negative and stopped there. Verse 14. Then Ahimelech answered the king and said, "And who is so faithful among all thy servants as David, who is the king's son-in-law, and goeth at thy bidding, and is honorable in thy house? Did I then begin to inquire of God for him? Be it far from me. Let not the king impute anything unto his servant, nor to all the house of my father, for thy servant knew nothing of all this, less or more." Now, that is all basically true, but he didn't need to say it. And sometimes we do the same thing. We don't always have to say everything that enters into our minds to say. As the bard wrote in Hamlet, "Since brevity is the soul of wit, Ahimelech should have stopped when he was ahead." Or maybe I should say he should have stopped when he still had his head. A simple, "No, my lord the king, I have not conspired with David." Too late. Verse 16, king says, "Thou shalt surely die, Ahimelech." Now he uses his name. "Thou and all thy father's house." Obviously, the punishment does not fit the crime. Where have we seen that in our day today, too? Nothing unusual there. Look at verse 17. "And the king said unto the footmen that stood about him, Turn, slay the priests of the Lord, because their hand also is with David, and because they knew when he fled, and they did not show it to me." But look at this. "But the servants of the king would not put forth their hand to fall upon the priests of the Lord." I have to say, this entire situation is startling to me. And it occurred to me when I was preparing this message that I would have never in past years applied this passage to our day like I have done a few times already here. But recently I have actually read opinion articles in the current day press questioning how would the U.S. military respond, how would they react if they were ordered to move against American citizens. People are actually wondering. The New York National Guard is, as we meet here tonight, patrolling the subways of New York City. Did any of us ever think this would happen in our beloved USA? The footmen, the servants, use both words out of the text, of the king, had more sense than the anointed king of Israel, and rightly refused a direct order to kill the priests of Yahweh. It might be wise in our day to pray, one, that our military is never ordered to act against our own citizens improperly, and two, if they are, that they are as fearful of committing wrong as Saul's servants were of offending God. I never thought I'd say such a thing in America today. So look who carries out Saul's irrational order. Sorry old Doeg the Edomite, who has as little respect for Yahweh as Saul does. One scholar wrote, through the hand of a foreigner, Saul perpetrates upon Israelites, priests of the Lord, what he himself did not perpetuate upon foreigners, the Amalekites. Do you remember what I said about remembering things that happened before that get brought up later? Do you remember what Saul didn't do when the Lord said, go destroy all the Amalekites? And you remember Samuel had to show up and say, why did you not obey the Lord? And Saul said, oh, I did. He said, then what's the bleating of that sheep that I hear? Remember that? Doeg was a real zealot. He went much further than even Saul had ordered. Look at verse 18. The king said to Doeg, turn now, fall upon the priest. Doeg the Edomite turned, fell upon the priest, slew on that day 85 persons that did wear a linen ephod. Verse 19. And Nob, the city of the priest, smote he with the edge of the sword both men and women, children and sucklings, oxen, asses, sheep, with the edge of the sword. You know, we occasionally, during times of war, will read reports of atrocities committed against an enemy, or worse, against innocent civilians. There are a couple of rather infamous ones. That's what Hamas just did recently in Israel on October the 7th. That's precisely what this is right here. All the way back to the livestock. Saul and Doeg are creating fear among the people. That's exactly what actions of atrocities in war do. Hitler accomplished very little bombing London, but he did it to strike fear into the London citizens. But God preserves one priest. Verse 20. One of the sons of Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, named Abathar, escaped and fled after David. And Abathar showed David that Saul had slain the Lord's priest. And David said to Abathar, I knew it that day when Doeg the Edomite was there, that he would surely tell Saul, I have occasioned the death of all the persons of my father's house. Abide thou with me, fear not, for he that seeketh my life seeketh thy life. But with me thou shalt be in safeguard. Now, from this point forward, the priesthood will be on David's side. And they'll depart from King Saul. King Saul will end up going to a witch. Yep, that's one of the words. Yep, spirit medium, witch. The king-elect and the new priest-elect are both on Saul's most wanted list. And David accepts that he has played a part in the deaths of Nob. But the truth is that Saul and Doeg are the ones that are 100% responsible for the deaths at Nob. Notice how all the important functions of government of a civilized people are moving from King Saul to king-elect David. The people have moved to David. The priesthood has moved to David. And the prophet Gad has moved to David. David is gaining support from all quarters, and Saul is becoming increasingly isolated. He is on the road in another direction. And once a person departs from the holy God of the Bible, he is on a path toward total destruction. And I'm going to tell you that I have old enough now that I can testify of Christians who forsook God and started down the wrong path, and I think the Lord took them home. Saul has begun to die spiritually, socially, psychologically, physically. Now, do you remember how I said that when we study the Bible, we're to be looking out for those little road signs, those little markers along the way, the things that remind us to look back at something in the past? Follow me on this one. Eli and Saul. Remember Eli? He's that priest way back yonder. Both refused to submit to God's authority. Eli, the priest, put his family before God. We do not want your priest, your sons, to be priests over us. Remember that? Consequently, God cut off Eli's family. Even though David was the cause of the 85 priests' death, this was one way God partially fulfilled the prophecy concerning Eli's descendants. So you got your finger in 1 Samuel? Turn back to chapter 2 real quick. Turn back to chapter 2 of 1 Samuel. Eli is getting toward the end of his days here. Look at verse 27. There came a man of God unto Eli and said to him, "Thus saith the Lord, did I plainly appear unto the house of thy father when they were in Egypt in Pharaoh's house? And did I choose him out of all the tribes of Israel to be my priest?" Who are we talking about? Aaron, right? "To offer upon my altar, to burn incense, to wear an ephod before me? And did I give unto the house of thy father all the offerings made by fire of the children of Israel? Wherefore," in other words, "why then, kick ye at my sacrifice and my offerings, which I have commanded in thy habitation, and honorest thy sons above me, to make yourself fat with the cheapest of all the offerings of Israel, my people? Why? Wherefore," verse 30, "the Lord God of Israel saith, I said indeed that thy house and the house of thy father should walk before me forever. But now the Lord says, be it far from me, for them that honor me I will honor, and they that despise me lightly shall be lightly esteemed. Behold, the days come." Well, here they are in chapter 22. Here they are. "The days come." Where did I leave off? What number? Thank you. "That I will cut off thine arm and the arm of thy father's house, that there shall not be an old man in thy house. And thou shalt see an enemy in thy habitation, in all the wealth which God shall give Israel, and there shall not be an old man in thy house forever. And the man of thine, whom I shall not cut off from mine altar, shall be to consume thine eyes and to grieve thine heart, and all the increase of thy house shall die in the flower of their age. And this shall be a sign unto thee, that shall come upon thy two sons, on Hophni and Phinehas. In one day they shall die, both of them. And I will raise me up a faithful priest, that would be Samuel, that shall do according to all which is in my heart and in my mind, and I will build him a sure house. And he shall walk before mine anointed forever. And it shall come to pass that every one that is left in thine house shall come and couch to him for a piece of silver and a morsel and bread, and shall say, put me, I pray thee, into one of the priest's offices, that I may eat a piece of bread. You put anything, anyone, even your own flesh and blood, your own son and daughter, above the Lord, and there will be a price to pay. God used David's folly to accomplish his will. So even in this scene that we're dealing with in chapter 22, David became a blessing. It does not justify David's lie in chapter 21, verse 2. It does show how that even in his sinning, God used David as a blessing. Saul the king put himself before God. Therefore, God cut off his life. Saul becomes increasingly paranoid, isolated from others, hateful toward his own supporters as well as his enemies, and guilty of shedding innocent blood. On the other hand, for me and you, when people submit to God's authority, they really begin to live. John chapter 10, verse 10, the thief cometh not but to steal and to kill and to destroy. But Jesus said, I am come that they might have life. That's great. But you know what's even greater? That they might have it more abundantly. Wow. David submitted to God's authority. His sins, including his deceiving of Ahimelech, which he did, bore bad consequences for himself and others. Nevertheless, God continues to bless David and use him. He blessed him personally. He blessed him by giving him the throne, and he blessed him by being used of the Lord to accomplish God's will in pruning Eli's descendants, which he did. So which side do you want to be on? Saul's? David's and God's? Answer is clear to you and me, in spite of David's obvious flaws. But we're in the beginning of watching David really start to begin to grow here. When David learns these lessons out in the wilderness, they're going to serve him well when he moves into the palace.